Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. In my remaining days at Wisconsin Public Radio, I've wanted as often as possible to hear from past guests who have offered political and historical wisdom, people who have observed America for many years, and James Fallows is one of those people, and I'm delighted he's with us this hour. He does have an article in the current Atlantic titled How American Presidents Used to Speak Overseas. The president's speech in Warsaw was notable for its seeming indifference to the American idea, and we will talk about the American idea. He also has a piece that he's writing on right now, Various Institutions of American Democracy and How They Are Functioning Now. But because it's the last time I'll speak with him, there are many other ideas I would like to discuss as well. James Fallows is national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. He's been writing for the magazine for over 25 years. He served as President Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter. He's the author of a number of books, including Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy, Looking at the Sun. And he has just ended, and we have talked to him about this project, which is a huge one, a five-month book writing leave in which he and his wife traveled all over America. He's also a pilot, so they flew in an airplane that he was piloting. Right? That's the right word for it. And they did that over the past 3.5 years. So he looked at towns, he and Deb, and libraries, and immigrants, and people all over the country, and will give us an idea of what the years ahead might mean for Americans. So we have a lot to talk about with him. And we'll welcome phone calls for James Fallows. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. James Fallows, a pleasure. Hello.
Kathleen, it's so nice to talk to you again now, as we've done over the years, so thanks for giving me this last chance.
Absolutely. It's always my pleasure to speak with you, and I want to cover so many years here. Let's start with the speech, because it will lead us into what the American idea is. You wrote a real interesting piece in The Atlantic recently, Is America an Idea?, and how the current president, Donald Trump, expressed what the idea was, and how other presidents probably expressed more accurately what an American idea is. What is the American idea as expressed by Donald Trump?
So the background, I'll answer indirectly for a second. You know, through America's history, if you have these two sort of overly simplified poles of America being an idea where we're going to embrace people from around the world and try to create a new nation, a new civilization, a new set of values and ideals, and America as being ethnically and tribally defined, as also it has been. You know, originally there was black slavery as America's original sin, and then there have been ethnic struggles as the U.S. has gone from a largely white European origin colonial population to include all the different elements we have. There have been tensions back and forth between how we think of what is us as Americans. But the point I was trying to make is that when they are going overseas, American presidents have erred on the side of stressing universality of America as an ideal, as a set of values, as an aspirational culture. And what was, and you can hear this in John F. Kennedy in Berlin saying, you know, we all stand with Berlin. Ronald Reagan making a very similar speech when he went to Berlin 25 years later. What was unusual in Donald Trump's speech in Warsaw, Poland, was essentially saying we are instead a culture, a people, a civilization that's under threat from different parts of the world. And while that's been an element in American history, American presidents haven't expressed it before in just the way Donald Trump did this time.
Mm-hmm. You were a speechwriter, chief speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. What were his comments in Poland?
Any of your listeners old enough to remember Carter's speech there 40 years ago, when I was traveling with him as a boy speechwriter. I was in my mid-20s then. He gave a speech, just his welcoming remarks at the airport in Warsaw late at night. It was almost midnight, and he was trying to stress the universality of the ideals that even then communist-controlled Poland had. He said that, he was saying, yes, there are these historic ties between Poles and Americans. There are millions of Poles who have come to the United States, and there are great Polish patriots who fought in the U.S. Revolution. Then he said, These brave men fought aside Americans in an era in which produced three of the great documents in the struggle for human rights. One was the Declaration of Independence from America. The second was the Declaration of the Rights of Man from France. And the third was the Polish Constitution of May 3rd, 1791. The point Carter was making was that Americans and French people and Poles had all aspired to these universal ideas of democracy and liberty. So he was stressing a conceptual connection among Americans, French, and Poles in the fight for human liberty, as opposed to simply the tribal bonds.
I know you're currently writing a piece on various institutions of American democracy, how they are functioning now. Let's start with the presidency. How is it functioning now?
I would say that Donald Trump, the man, is more or less what I anticipated. Almost nothing he has done has surprised me. As I think we discussed last year, during the campaign, I did a daily chronicle of things that Donald Trump, the candidate, had said or done that were out of the range of previous presidential major party nominees. I got to installment number 152 by election day of things that just were different from Donald Trump. And I think in his personal bearing, in his knowledge or lack thereof of substance, in just the way he is, I think Donald Trump in office has been a logical extrapolation of Donald Trump, the candidate. So I think that he has been the least surprising part of the whole element. And would you like me to suggest other parts of the mix?
Please do.
So I think that the judiciary has been quite impressive in its calmness and its independence in the last while. It's not the fact that their judgments have largely been curbing in a number of Donald Trump's attempts. It's simply that they have acted as if this were still normal times and as if normal rules still applied. So I think the judiciary has been impressive so far. I think that the press, in different ways, has tried to cope with the challenges of these times. I think the Washington Post, which had been financially challenged and other ways having trouble over the past 20 years or so, has found a new life for itself. And I think that in its editorial commentary and its investigations, it has found a way to kind of reassert what were some of its best times. There's others we could talk about. I think the institution that is most problematic right now is the Congressional Republican Party. And the reason I say that is that I know firsthand, and almost any of your listeners would know just by guess and by common sense, that people who've been in the Senate for a long time and people who've been in the House even for a shorter time, they know that what is happening now is not normal. They know it's not normal for three senior figures of a presidential campaign to meet with somebody they've told is working for foreign intelligence. They know that it's not normal to not disclose your income tax returns. They know a lot of the rest of this is not normal, and they are not saying so. And that is something that I think will look quite odd historically, and I hope that in some time before the eons pass historically, the pressure and intensity will mount on Republicans to defend what they know are the real values of the country.
James, do you think that this presidency is in jeopardy?
2 years, a little more than 2 years ago, 25 months ago, I wrote very confidently on the Atlantic site that a person like Donald Trump could not become president. That was the last prediction I made on anything involving Donald Trump. So I don't know. I know that members of the Republican Party serving in the Senate and the House know that what is happening now is outside all the normal bonds. And so at what point they bring their knowledge to some kind of action, to have an investigation, to ask for disclosure, at some point this loop will close. After my 25-month-ago prediction, I make no other predictions, but this is not normal.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about immigration for a while and refugees. I know that you have written about this, and it will be a part of the book, which I eagerly await. What a wonderful experience you and Deb had traveling all over the country. You have blogged about this and written about refugees, immigrants, and the battle over who is American, and have looked at what's involved in settling immigrants from Syria, Somalia, Congo, all other places in American cities. Can you talk a little bit about this, what you saw in your travels?
Yes, and first let me take 20 seconds just for what to me is the relevant historical background. Through as much of American history as I have ever studied, and actually a fair amount of I've lived through myself now, immigration has never been trouble-free. You know, that whether it's the Irish, the Germans, the 1840s, the Irish in the mid-19th century, the Italians and Poles and Greeks and Russian Jews and everybody else, the Vietnamese a generation ago, always immigration has been disruptive in the United States as it has been around the world. That is on the one hand. On the other hand, what makes the United States distinctive is that we have found ways to continue to absorb people and to reap what, in my view, are the benefits of having an open, diverse, innovative society in which people from around the world can apply their talents. And most of what we saw city by city was that process still going on in the Dakotas, in Sioux Falls, for example, which is a big refugee resettlement center now. Now, we saw Somalis and Sudanese and people from the Congo and other places being absorbed mainly by Catholic charities and Lutheran charities and finding ways to become part of the fabric of you know, part of America's Great Plains Society. Certainly in Wisconsin and Minnesota, you know about refugee populations over the past generation. In western Kansas and Dodge City and Garden City, Kansas, which are largely meatpacking centers now, the population is largely a slight majority of Latino. In those cities now, that the school population is very heavily Latino, and the mainly Anglo voting population of cities like Dodge City and Garden City is passing new bond issues to be able to educate properly their now largely Latino school population. In Fresno, in the Central Valley of California, which had been historically an Armenian center, and then Hmong population a generation ago, they're finding ways to make a virtue rather than a handicap of a diverse population. The main point I would make is you would think from our national political rhetoric that this was a time when Americans were on edge, frightful, and resentful of a new immigrant presence. And that is true where the immigrant population is least. Where the immigrant and refugee population is more present, the fear and resentment of them seems to be, seems to be at its lowest ebb. You don't hear build a wall chants in Arizona or Texas or California. You hear more of them in New Hampshire.
Hmm. You asked the question, and this is certainly worth pondering, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are, whether America is better as a more racially and culturally diverse society or one that is more traditional.
I will give you I'll explain the reasons. I'll give you my own personal biased opinion, and first I'll explain the reasons for my biases. I've spent, as you and I have discussed over the years, I've spent probably more than 15 years of my life living outside the United States. I lived in Japan, I lived in Southeast Asia, I lived in England, I've been in Africa, I lived in China for a very long time. And you spend your time in those circumstances thinking what it is that makes the United States unusual as a culture. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is highest on the list from my point of view is the idea that it can incorporate people from around the world. You know, Japan sort of shrieks, runs in horror from that prospect. Many European countries think they can do it, but they have a hard time. China just is sort of too big and sprawling to incorporate many non-Chinese people. The fact that the United States can theoretically absorb talent from around the world, in my view, is a huge advantage to the United States. It means, for one thing, we're the only rich country that also has a relatively young population because our immigrant population is younger than the existing population. It means we have what I view as the advantages of a diverse outlook on things. If you have people from Africa and Southeast Asia and China and Germany and Greece and Israel and Russia all applying their perspectives to a problem, you're likely to have a wider range of answers to it. It also means, just in the crassest sense, we have an outsized share of the world's talent. The U.S. has about, say, 5% of the world's population, roughly. You could say we have 10 or 15% of the world's most ambitious entrepreneurs, scientists, researchers who want to work within our borders. So I think, in my view, this is the great American advantage, which I would be very sorry to see us throwing away.
I want to spend some time talking about the Rust Belt cities that you and Deb visited on your long trip across the country. You talk a lot about Erie, Pennsylvania, the representative American city of this moment, a declining Rust Belt city that, as you write, illustrates the fears and dislocations that led to Donald Trump. So you were in the community looking at an older Erie, people who hoped they could go to work at the GE plant, but it's slow, it's shutting down. And then a younger Erie, and I'm wondering how representative this is of other declining cities, people who are starting new businesses. Is that a big thing in Erie, Pennsylvania? Is it a big thing in other cities that have seen so many plants leave their area and have vast unemployment result from that?
So certainly each city's circumstances differ, and there's some that are doing better than others. And we've been, we spent a lot more time in Duluth, which is, of course, a quasi-neighbor of Wisconsin.
Love
than
Duluth.
In Wisconsin. Yeah, mm-hmm. Duluth I love too. And we have, the next place we would go if we were going to a next place, which we will, would be actually Eau Claire. Which I think shows many of these same tendencies. But Erie, I think, is a useful proxy for Rust Belt dumb in general. We've also been in Allentown and in Pittsburgh briefly, and in Columbus, Ohio, which is quite large, and Charleston, West Virginia, which is quite troubled, and Louisville to some degree. But Erie is a very stark version of the classic Rust Belt situation where 100 years ago it was a big, diversified manufacturing town. Over the last half century or so, its dominant manufacturer has been a big GE plant that made locomotives. And it's still, the GE plant still employs a couple thousand people, but it is in a long-term, unquestioned decline. Interestingly, the jobs there are not going to Mexico or Taiwan or something. They're going to Texas. And they're going to Texas for largely, you know, labor issues in Erie. And so if you are my age as a baby boomer in his 60s, even though I gasp to say that, if you're in that age in Erie, the story of the town as you've seen it is a road downward. You see these empty industrial buildings. You see the GE plant sort of shuttering down, you know, one division by another, and there are a few people there than were before, and you think, gee, my children are not going to be able to have the same kind of career in the GE plant. And the people from the children's generation and younger than that, they never imagined they are going to have that career in GE, just because its decline has been visible for so long, mm-hmm. as is the case with many steelworks, as is the case with many automobile plants, and certainly with the coal mine, which has been in decline for 100 years in Appalachia. So the younger people, some of them have moved away. Some of them are involved in the genuine crisis opioid situation, which is a real problem across the United States. It is somewhat related to economic decline, but I think it's entirely, it has its own momentum. But quite a few of them are saying there are opportunities here for a new kind of industrial and technological growth. And there are several forces propelling this. One is that Erie, like a number of other northern United States cities, view refugees and immigrants as their source of refreshment, of population refreshment. Hmm. Something like 10% of the population of Erie now, they're actual refugees. These are people from the Balkans, from Syria, from places in Africa, from Nepal, from Cambodia, from the Congo, from other places. And they feel as if the opportunities in Erie, which look bleak to somebody from New York City, are quite promising for them. Also, there's a number of advanced high-end manufacturing startups there. That the Penn State has a campus there known as the Barron Campus. They're doing a bunch of very high-end things. Communications, high-speed internet mean there's a kind of tech and design community in downtown Erie, which is using the advantages of low-cost real estate to have new things starting there. I recently had a website redesigned, which was done by people in Erie because they could do it as well as people anyplace else and for a lower cost. And so there is a civic fabric, and also, meanwhile, Erie Insurance, which is a very large, very successful Erie-based company, is investing in the downtown. So if the story of America, in my view, is continuing cycles of rebirth and decline, of creation and destruction, of people doing new things, as my parents and my grandparents did. You see that cycle being played out in Erie, and I think also in South Bend, Indiana, and also in many parts of Ohio. That is how America has gone through these cycles.
Interesting. We did an interesting show yesterday with some mayors, result of the Miami conference on the U.S. Mayors Conference, and their look at climate change and their dismay at our withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord. It was an interesting discussion because a lot of things are being done on a local level by mayors, certainly by states in this country. Is that where you're seeing innovations, where you're seeing change and new ideas? Because the administration is so mired not only in controversy but in partisanship that not much is coming from Washington.
So I think to have another, 12-second stroll down history's lane, I find myself obsessed with the history of the United States from like 1880 to about 1915, because then you had all the challenges of the first Gilded Age, which we're replicating right now, of technological dislocation and large-scale immigration and extremes of wealth and poverty and all of that, but also the beginning of the progressive era and people having all these experiments and how the United States could find new answers to these new problems. And there's this famous quote from Justice Brandeis back, in the 1930s, but looking back on that era, saying that states were the laboratories of democracy. I think much more cities are the laboratories of democracy now and of innovative climate approaches, innovative educational approaches, innovative new manufacturing and startup approaches, because life seems manageable at the city level. And mayors are not able just to have some kind of partisan gridlock and talk about the problems. They have to actually do things. So I think that people looking back on our era will see many of the solutions on climate issues, on educational issues, on manufacturing issues coming city by city. And we hope they are connected nationwide. And that's a lot of the story that Deb and I have been writing in our book, which will be out next year sometime.
What's the name of it? Do you know?
Well, good question. There are about four or five different titles. You'll be the first to know when we figure out which one. You know, there's the joke in Hollywood of films called Working Title. So when they start, so this is Working Title, to be determined soon.
Thank you, James.
It could be The American Story. It could be The Americans. It could be many things. We'll let you know.
All right. James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's written for them since the late 1970s. He was Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter. He's the author of many books, has spent a number of years of his career working outside the country, many years, as you heard him say, in Asia, a lot of years in China, in London, in various places. He's written many, many books, and we're talking to him about a wide range of topics this hour. Most recently, his article in The Atlantic is about Donald Trump's speech in Warsaw, Poland, and how other presidents, including Jimmy Carter, gave different kinds of speeches about the American idea in Poland and elsewhere. And he is also working on another piece for The Atlantic on American institutions and how they are faring right now. So feel free to join this conversation. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are appreciative of your comments there. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is The Ideas Network. James Fallows is with us now. Let's go to phone calls. We start with Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Sarah.
It's so nice to talk to you.
And you as well.
thank you. Okay, well, your guest is talking about the judiciary and Congress. And first with the judiciary, I think about them a lot because I wonder if there's going to be ever some sort of standoff between a ruling they make and, what Donald Trump wants. And you said you were so impressed with them, but I just have to wonder, how else could they be behaving right now? I mean, are they just going to, they couldn't just roll over and, not do anything, or are you impressed because they're not, going and making impassioned speeches or something? And also, when you say that there are a lot of Republicans in Congress who know this isn't normal, I hear that a lot, but then no one ever does say anything. And so how do you know that there are, and who are they, and how many? Is it just a couple, Susan Collins, or is there a lot?
So those are both interesting questions. Thank you very much for them. To start with the second one, I know there are Republican, both senators and representatives, who think that Donald Trump is not fit for office, that he's dangerously impulsive, that he is a threat to world peace and the Republic, because I have heard them say that with my own ears. And these were in, of course, they will not say these things on the record, but I, over the past year, both during the campaign when they didn't really think he was going to become president, in the last week or two of the campaign when they still didn't, when they didn't think he was going to be the nominee, the last week or two of the campaign where they didn't think he was going to win the election, and in these, you know, 8 months or whatever it's been since the election, as they are coping with him in office, there is a, on the one hand, logical feeling for many of them. They think that they have more to fear within the Republican electorate if they oppose him than if they support him. So that's one point. On the other hand, they recognize that the standards of normal executive leadership, of respect for institution, of grounds for logic, of how people make decisions, that none of these has anything to do with the way Donald Trump is approaching the world. And so they are smart enough, most of them, many of them, to recognize this is an abnormal situation, but they feel, I think, incorrectly that they are better served keeping their mouths shut and continuing to vote with them. And I think the classic thing is the over the past week when the news has come out about Donald Trump Jr. and his meetings with Russian representatives, of senators saying they're worried by this, they're troubled, they're concerned, but they're not going to vote for an investigation. They're not going to say, let's see your income tax returns or all the rest. So the question is when, what it will take to move them from what I think is a historically inappropriate position of recognizing a problem but not acting on it. We'll see what makes them feel they can shift. So the judiciary, yes. So the judiciary, they're doing their job, I agree, but it's notable that they are doing their job.
And James, do you think that these Republicans, and particularly those who are up for re-election in the midterms, politically, are they better to be quiet about this because their re-election will depend on Donald Trump's base voting?
So members of, yes, so let's take members of the House, every single one of whom is going to be facing the voters a year from now. And the way that gerrymandering has gone in the House of Representatives of the past generation, most of the incumbent Republicans are in, you know, strong Republican districts, so they feel they have more to lose by angering their base than they have to gain by trying to win some of the Democrats. So you can say that for many of these Republican representatives, it's rational. The person I don't understand is, for example, John McCain. John McCain is, number one, a person of mature years who might not ever run again for Senate. Number two is a person who was just reelected last year and is not going to run for five more years if you're going to run at all. Number three is a person who was personally mocked by Donald Trump.
Yes.
When Donald Trump said early on, oh, you're a loser for being a captive. And number four, who has epitomized in his career some of the bravery that we like to think of our public leaders. So why Senator McCain is not willing actually to vote against, not willing actually to vote for investigations or for disclosure or the rest, I frankly don't understand that. And there are others in that category who you think could serve themselves better, not simply in history's eyes, but in practical politics now, by being the leaders of saying, okay, let's stand for actual small R Republican values, the values of this republic.
Mm. You mentioned gerrymandering. The Supreme Court is going to hear that case stemming from Wisconsin that could have really profound national ramifications, couldn't it?
It certainly could. And let me brag for a moment at my own home state of California, where Arnold Schwarzenegger, the former governor, who is not going to be running for president because he was born in Austria, but the most impressive thing he did when governor was to force through an honest districting scheme for California, where there's this independent nonpartisan commission that through some kind of actual algorithm comes up with congressional districts for the, I think, you know, for the very large number of seats. Was it 55, 53, some huge number of seats that are in California. Mm-hmm. And he's leading a campaign to make this a nationwide practice so you don't have the situation now where most notably in the states of Pennsylvania and Ohio, and to a lesser degree North Carolina, in both Pennsylvania and Ohio, I believe this was the case in the last election. I know it's the case in the elections before that. Most of the voters voted for Democratic representatives, but the delegation that was chosen was overwhelmingly Republican because of the way that the districts were drawn. So that is not how small-D democracy is supposed to work. So redistricting in general is a very, very important Democratic small-D issue.
Sarah, thanks very much for your call. James Fallows, our guest. Our phone number, if you want to join this interesting conversation, is 800-486-8655. Regina in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Regina.
Hi. I just want to reiterate what the first caller mentioned. I am so angry with members in Congress. We vote for the president, but we also vote for them. And I can't understand how we can have voted for people who are so self-serving and thinking of their own careers and so forth, and not being people of integrity. And recognizing, and I don't mean this as a pun, recognizing that we have an elephant in the White House and an emperor who is clothed only in false words. I appreciated your guest's comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Regina.
So thanks, Regina. So I don't know exactly which part of Wisconsin Regina is from, but history
Milwaukee.
Will note that the... Okay. Well, the Speaker of the House of Representatives is not from Milwaukee, but he is from Wisconsin.
Right.
And he is straddling this boundary of Paul Ryan certainly knows what is wrong with Donald Trump. And he knows the ways in which history is going to look very unkindly on a lot of things Donald Trump is doing right now, from the emoluments clause to these foreign entanglements to simply not releasing his tax returns or not going through normal procedure. I would think that, you can tell me, Kathleen, whether Paul Ryan's district would support this, but I would think that he would do better in his district in the long run to be the leader of the principled small r and large r Republican standards for the values the country was founded on. You also have a Senator Johnson, who is part of this concerned but not acting on it Republican delegation in the Senate. I do not know him personally, so he is not among the group of Republicans I'm referring to from whom I've heard directly their concerns about Donald Trump. But I bet he understands what's going on here. So, people of Wisconsin, speak to your representatives.
If you can get through on the phone to them, that's another problem.
Yes, exactly.
The phones aren't being answered. 800-486-8655 is our number. Jay in Madison is next. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Kathleen. Congratulations on your retirement.
Thanks,
miss
Jay.
You.
Thank you.
And Mr. Fallows first came to my attention, I guess it was 46 years ago, and he wrote a terrific article called The Education of David Stockman. Stockman was Ronald Reagan's first budget director and was a proponent of Reaganomics, but I guess inside of about a year in that position, he, according to Mr. Fallows, he realized that it was phony. And my question is, number one, is Mr. Fallows, are you still in touch at all with Stockman? What would Stockman be saying today, given that now supply-side economics has been revived and is now being pushed forward yet again by the Trump administration and the Republican Party?
Thanks very much for remembering that. And so I have a variety of points. Number one, I was certainly the midwife of that article. Bill Greider was the guy who actually interviewed Stockman. So I was involved in that. But Bill Greider, then of the Washington Post, now of many Rolling Stone and a book writer, was very crucially involved in that. Stockman is a fascinating figure in the context of our previous conversation because he had been a true believer in supply-side economics. But then as Ronald Reagan's budget director, he started saying, wait a minute, this is just not working at all. And so in an emperor's new clothes type way, he talked with us at the Atlantic, with Bill Greider, with the rest of us, saying this is not going to work. And so if there were only some Stockman-like figures right now who would say we stand for something beyond partisan interests of this moment, David Stockman has become, I'm not really in touch with him. I last heard him speak maybe a year or a year and a half ago. He is quite a dark scenario person. now. He was saying if he was warning about budget problems then, back in the 1980s, he is really concerned now. And so if you, I am at heart an American optimist. He is at heart an American pessimist. And he thinks we are really going off the cliff. And everything about Donald Trump, he, you know, if he was worried about Ronald Reagan, he's worried to the nth degree about Donald Trump. And he would have a much less cheering perspective to offer than his education of David Stockman back in the early 1980s. But thanks for remembering that.
Yeah, I haven't heard the name Stockman in a long time. Let's go back to the Republicans and what they need to get reelected. This health care, we keep getting a new version. We have another version today. This issue, as you well know, James, is a huge issue for Americans. It is number one. They may be concerned about the ethical parts of the administration and what the president is doing, but they're concerned about their health care, rightfully so. And the Republicans have yet to come up with a plan. It seems to me as though they need to nail this.
This is like nothing I have seen before in my now depressingly long career as a journalist, nor nothing I've read about in American history in the following way. Every indication is that all versions of this Republican bill are really unpopular. You know,
right.
15% approval, 18% approval. The procedure that's being used to get them through is unlike anything in our modern history. The Clinton Care bill had hearings over a year and a half. The Obama Hill bill had, you know, countless hearings and negotiations with the other side. And like it or dislike it, it was a process. It was a result of an actual process. This thing is being pushed through without hearings of any kind, without involvement of the other party at all, in the face of what looks like very robust unpopularity, and still it is going through. And any of your normal sort of Newtonian physics of how things happen are challenged by this, because why is the Republican Party voting for it so strongly if the public seems to be against it?
I guess
there are two answers. One is there's a sense from Trump himself that he has to, quote, have done something, unquote. This will be an achievement. You saw the champagne being broken out after the House got its version through under Paul Ryan's, quote, leadership, unquote, earlier in the spring. So, number one, it's getting something done. This is something, so let us get it done. And number two, there is a part of the party that really cares about repealing Obamacare, even if it's unpopular. You know, damn the torpedoes, we're going to repeal this thing. So that part of the party seems to have more attention in the minds of Senator Johnson, in the minds of Senator Collins, in the minds of all these people who are on the fence, than the majority that seems to be against this bill. So I have never seen anything like this. If they go ahead with it, on logical grounds, seems to invite punishment next year in the midterms, but that seems to be where we are headed.
Jay, thanks for the call. Timothy in Prairie Farm, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Timothy.
Yes, I just find it very almost amusing when I hear so many programs like this, and I listened to CNN last night and listened to Lawrence, whatever his last name is, as he was saying that it's like he knew that Donald Trump Jr. was already treasonous in his activities and so on, instead of letting the process make its way, calling some of the elected officials, whether it was talking about mental deficiency for the former George W. Bush or any kind of comments like that about Obama, and now about Trump being unfit for the office. What a bias that you show in the media.
Well, feel free to sing his praises. What do you like about Donald Trump, Timothy?
What do I like about him?
Sure.
Straightforward, honest businessman who has done something for himself, and he wants to do the same in cutting costs and getting things done in government, and that's exactly what he's on target to do. So that's what he's standing for. But all of the maligning and calling him mentally unstable and all this, that's just absurd. Obviously,
James, go ahead.
So I understand your perspective. Let's be precise about what I said. I have not used and will not use this word treason. Donald Trump Jr. released emails in which he personally released emails in which he personally responds saying, you know, if so, I love it, to somebody saying we have information involving the Russian government. That's what the incoming email said, which could damage Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump Jr. said, I love it, if true. So that's what Donald Trump Jr. said. I'm telling you that I have heard from incumbent Republican senators and representatives themselves their concern about Donald Trump's fitness. I'm reporting to you things I have heard.
I heard that.
Well, I'm telling you, I've heard it directly.
Bias. You would never have said things like that about Obama, for example.
Because no members of his party who were incumbent senators, many members of his own party didn't like him. They thought he was cold. They thought he was aloof. Donald Trump and other people said that they thought that Obama was not actually a citizen. In my experience of talking with people, I never heard a Republican senator say that he or she thought that Obama was unfit. I have heard incumbent Republican office holders say that about Donald Trump.
Thanks, Timothy, for your call. Dan in Green Bay. Hi. Are you there, Dan?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I share your concerns about gerrymandering in the House. However, you can't gerrymander the Senate, and you can't gerrymander the president because the entire electorate takes place. So my thought is that if the American public's fed up with Trump, then it's going to take care of itself. He won't be reelected in 4 years, and the Senate will switch from the Republicans to the Democrats, and the whole process will correct itself. On the other hand, I'm a little worried that this guy's a little bit like Andrew Jackson, where intellectual people don't like him, but the common man does, and he might end up, you know, they might get exactly what they want, and it just might continue. But, you know, the proof's in the pudding, and in the end of the day, the time will tell.
So, yes, I certainly agree that the whole, if we have any faith at all in democracy, we think time will tell. And if Donald Trump is reelected, then he has earned that reelection, and we will see. It's interesting that the Senate is by definition gerrymandered. That because there are two votes per state, and because the skew in state populations is now so extreme and so much different than when the Constitution was drafted. When the Constitution was drafted, the most populous state, which was Virginia, had 10 times as many people as the least populous state, which was Delaware at that time. Right now, the proportion is more than 70 to 1. California has 70 times as many people as Wyoming does. And so you can have the 48 Democratic and independent senators now represent many more people than do the 52 Republican senators. But that is part of the American deal. But yes, there is a feedback loop. Donald Trump's popularity ratings have been the lowest of any modern president. But if he manages to bring them up and if more people support him, then he will deserve reelection.
I think this is a good time before we take more phone calls and pause for a moment to talk about somebody you have spent a lot of time with and you write about, Charlie Peters. Once upon a time, American culture genuinely was less selfish and money-minded than it is now. The New Deal motto, we do our part, sense of civic obligation, shared hardships we had during the 30s and the 40s. Maybe we could return to that?
Yes, this will be the only book plug I deliver on the show for a relatively new book by my friend Charlie Peters called We Do Our Part. Charlie, who is now in his early 90s, grew up in West Virginia, in Charleston, West Virginia. He grew up in the time of FDR. His father was a small-town, modest lawyer. Charlie was in the Army in World War II. He went into Columbia on the GI Bill after the war, and he became involved in politics. He was in the West Virginia legislature. He ran John F. Kennedy's campaign in West Virginia, where this historic primary campaign showing that a Catholic could win the votes of a sort of hard-bitten Protestant state. And then he was a very important official in the Peace Corps through the 8 years of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. Then he founded a magazine called The Washington Monthly, where I got my first magazine job just out of graduate school back in the early 1970s. And Charlie is a great American and says there are these, you could think of him as the magazine equivalent of Frank Capra, or of just saying that there are certain American values that through our ups and downs we need to come back to. And I think any of your readers who read Charlie's book, We Do Our Part, will have a sense both of how America looks to somebody who has lived through FDR and the Depression and World War II and the idealism of the Kennedy era and all the ups and downs since then, and also a sense of what we could do to try to recapture some of those civic virtues.
Mm. Is he doing radio interviews, James? Do you know?
I think that he might, and I will. Okay. I can give him a call after
Thank
we're done
you,
and say that if there's any phone call he should take, it should be yours.
Thank you, James. Thanks. That'd be great. I'd like to talk to him. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. James Fallows is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. I started the hour by saying, as you know, I'm retiring in just a few weeks now, and I wanted to have a chance to be sure and speak with people who I've loved talking to over the past 24 years here on public radio, and James Fallows is on that list for sure. So he's kind enough to join us to talk about all kinds of issues. He is writing still for The Atlantic, and he and his wife have spent 3.5 years traveling the United States before the election, looking at, you know, what ails people, what people are excited about, how jobs are changing, the good things, the things people are struggling with all over America. He flies an airplane, and so he and his wife flew all over the country, and it's going to be the subject of his forthcoming book, to be titled soon. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Anne in Platteville. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to follow up partly with the quote that you gave before, because I'm really concerned about the lack of Commonwealth awareness that people have, and it's in our state. It's certainly apparent in our government, in our federal government, meaning that people are worshiping the dollar and not paying attention to the environment, paying attention to people and what will help them. And the shocking number of people who didn't vote in the last election, who don't vote in elections. I'm frankly also, I need your American cheerfulness. I'm extraordinarily, I am going to be 65. I come from a long line of actually Republicans. I'm not, but I come from Republicans, and the idea of voting and being civic minded and doing what you can has always been important, but that I feel like I'm living in a different world.
James, let's get an answer.
Yes. On the one hand, I know what you mean, and there are lots of things to be downcast about and to be seriously concerned about. I would offer these two reasoned bits of hopefulness. One is, I studied American history when I was in college, and that's the main thing I read about. And one of the messages of American history is that there have always been big problems in this country. Yeah, there was slavery for a couple of centuries, and the late 1800s were about as corrupt and venal as anything we're going through now. And the 1920s had their problems. So the story of the United States is largely a story of really serious problems and people finding ways to deal with them. That doesn't mean we'll deal with today's problems, but it means that we've been in places like this before. The other thing which I have seen and really believe is that while national politics
the
are
in last caller.
Yes, the while national politics are in a very troubling situation, city by city and some places states by state, communities do have many of the virtues we would associate with the America we would like to believe in. And so that's part of the message we're trying to get out in this book. And also, I will say as a free plug here, one reason I've been so much enjoyed coming on the show over the years and talking with Kathleen is that public radio is one of these very important connecting media
you,
around
James.
Around
it
the country
is.
And talking with you, Kathleen, has been such a privilege.
Thanks, James. It's been wonderful to have you. And keep writing. I'll keep reading everything that you write, and I'll look forward to the book. And we will get a hold of Mr. Peters and see if he can join us in the weeks that are ahead. I just think you're so darn well spoken. I don't know how you learned to talk so good, but you're a great guest.
It's Well, it's a real privilege to talk with you and listen to you, and so thanks for giving me this chance again.
Yeah, our pleasure, James. James Fallows, our guest this hour. He's a longtime writer for The Atlantic. We started the hour with his latest piece, which is what President Trump had to say in Poland. James was the chief speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. He's the author of 10 books, spent a number of years living outside the country in Asia and also in England and Africa and various other places. And he and his wife went on this remarkable journey. He blogged about it, and we talked with him about it some months ago, visiting all over the United States to find out how people are dealing with their jobs, how they're dealing with immigration issues, how they're dealing with a changing economy, with partisanship, and all of that. And so he's going to have a book, he and Deb, and it will be coming out in just a little while. Thanks very much to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour, and to Gretchen as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Thanks so much for all of your calls. And we'll be with you next hour to talk about the road to Camelot. So please stay with us.